All these many centuries later, the Bhagavad Gita still stands and continues to inspire and instruct generations of truth seekers whose lives have, the way the world has changed, have taken such a completely different tact. And there's so many aspects of the Bhagavad Gita that are worth noting, not the least of which is the very last lines, which were not being read today, but are worth remembering. The Bhagavad Gita is this conversation. Excuse me, I have to clear my throat here. The Bhagavad Gita is this intense conversation between the disciple Arjuna and his guru, the incarnation of the divine Krishna. And it doesn't take place casually over a cup of tea. It takes place in the middle of a battle in which not only the life of Arjuna is at stake, but the entire fate of his kingdom, the fate of his brothers, the fate of his lineage. Krishna has a deep vested interest in the triumph of righteousness over evil. And they're having this conversation when Arjuna hesitates to engage. The battle is both historical and allegorical. The field of Kurukshetra, on which it takes place, is a physical place you can go and visit, but it's really the field of consciousness, and the battle is between the subconscious habits and the superconscious potential. And Arjuna is the devotee caught in the middle. And just when he's supposed to pick up his weapons and start slashing away at all his limitations, who happen also to be his cousins, in the way that the story is all interwoven beautifully, he says to Krishna, "I'm not really sure this is such a good idea. There's a whole lot of reasons why I'd really rather not do this." And then the battle stops for a time, and Krishna and Arjuna go off and have a conversation about it. And that conversation is very wide-ranging, covers all aspects, really, of life, from all approaches, the meaning of life, the meaning of death, the meaning of battle, the option not to fight, all of this. At the very end of it, it's been quite intense and quite enduring. Krishna says to Arjuna, "Now you've heard all the options. Now do whatever you feel." And then that's the end. That's how the whole thing ends. And you would expect Krishna to say something like, "Okay, buddy, now that you see what's at stake here, you know, go out there and fight." But he doesn't. He says, "Do what you feel," which is a fascinating sort of dimension, one more dimension of true self-realization, which is what the path, what the Bhagavad Gita represents. Also what the Bible represents, but less clearly. We have to do a lot more interpreting to find it in the Bible. Yesterday and later this afternoon, I've been participating in a small conference that's going on in San Francisco. It's called How to Have an Extraordinary Life. It's sponsored by a well-known and quite well-respected woman who is a professional psychic. That's her definition of herself. And she's collected a lot of very interesting people together, of whom I hope I am one. And it's not highly attended, but it's been fun. A woman came up to me after I spoke, and she was buying a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi from us, and she said to me, "I understand Yogananda's path is very arduous," she said like that. And you could see that the options that were being presented at the conference were more attractive to her. How to get what you want in various forms. How to understand why you were born and have more fun doing it, and then one or two or three or ten variations on how to get what you want, using more elevated principles. It's interesting, the Vedas have lots of formulas in them for how to get what you want. When you read the book Milarepa, Tibet's Greatest Yogi, which is really quite a fascinating read, you find out that Milarepa, before he was a good man, was a terrible man. Of course, he probably exaggerated, but he did some pretty darn stinky things. His mother was cheated out of her land, and so she commissioned her son to punish those who had cheated them. So he went and he learned black magic. And he learned black magic very powerfully. And then he instigated a hailstorm that just destroyed the land of their enemies. That's all. And then when they were all cheerfully wiped out, he'd fulfilled his debt to his mother and he was free to go on. Now, there are lots of, as I say, instructions in the holy books of spells for getting revenge, getting children, attracting money. I said, Swamiji, why would the saints and sages teach people how to fulfill their egoic desires? And Swami's answer, which I presume is a valid one, he said, well, that's what people are going to pursue anyway. So the sages thought if they got the idea that their wishes could be fulfilled through the holy books, as their wishes elevated, they would continue to look in the holy books for the answers. I mean, such a appallingly practical point of view, isn't it? Because otherwise, we're just completely worldly. We think it's all coming from us. And we have no sense of the divine. And when would we turn toward God? So when this woman said to me, the path of Yogananda is very arduous, I said, well, you can never do more than you can do, ever. So I don't know why you would call it arduous. You stand where you stand, and you turn in the direction that you want to go. And you take a step that's about as long as your legs, and that's the only step you can take. How can that be arduous, one step at a time? I said, it is serious. It's not like we just go away for a weekend, have a good time together, and then just come back to our ordinary lives. There is a goal. That goal is all pervasive, and that goal is serious. This isn't just another way to get what we want, except on a much higher and a much deeper level. Meaning what we really want that will satisfy us forever. Now, I've been often different themes start running through my thinking at various times, and this Gita commentary is exactly what I've been thinking a lot about lately. It seems to me that let me think how to say this exactly. There's the dilemma that all of us face, which was exactly encapsulated by that woman's statement, which is that we are really a house divided against ourselves almost all the time. Once we have this sort of vague idea, which tends to come to us through some experience, it's rarely just an intellectual thought, at some point or another, we catch the wave that there is a potential for joy here that's a whole lot bigger than what I was grabbing at before. One of my friends, when he found Autobiography of a Yogi, he said he started reading it when he was going on a big camping trip up a mountain. He said he went up the mountain an agnostic and he came down a devotee of God. And that was sort of like Yogananda opened his eyes through Autobiography of a Yogi to another potential. But between having our eyes first opened and actually sincerely and deeply wanting to only live in that reality, that's the place that we're all sort of swimming in right now, isn't it? When I first came to Ananda, to the teachings of Ananda and moved into the community, I was 24, had a very free spirit about life. I wasn't worried about anything, and I just embraced it wholeheartedly with complete enthusiasm and never looked back, never did look back. But about 6 or 7 years into it, the little group of women, my coterie of women friends, and we were all living as renunciates together, and we kind of realized we had gotten in for a lot more than we knew. It's like there had been this very pretty door that we had walked through. But then we were far enough into it, as someone said, a lot of people talk about overcoming the ego, but you guys really mean it. And so there we were, and we really were beginning to realize this was no walk in the park. This was no weekend jaunt. And then I can just sort of click this one off. But we had, as I put it, we had dove into the water. We were swimming madly and enthusiastically toward the island. We were not even halfway there, but we were too far from shore to just turn around and go back. And as we were sort of I would think about as we were treading water talking about our options. You know, like, do we go forward? Do we go back? Do we just sort of go 1, 2, 3 and just go down here? Is this it? But as Master put it, he said, once you've tasted something really fine, you know, rotten food just won't satisfy you anymore. We're too far forward to go back, not far enough forward to be free, and treading water and thinking about what to do. And that's where we live for a really long time. Even Arjuna asked Krishna this question. He says, what if I give up all the pleasures of this life and the power and the self-aggrandizement and the praise and all of that, but I don't actually realize God? So I don't get the prize. I've given up the easy comforts and I don't get the prize. It was to that question that Krishna said, my devotee is never lost. You are always with me. Once that desire for freedom awakes in your heart, I never let go of you. And then he says, wherever you are, when you pass away from this life, that's where you start again. You just pick up exactly where you left off. Birth and death are extremely arbitrary units of time. It's our consciousness just has to go where it has to go. Now then, the challenge becomes not about the path and not about God, not about the guru, but entirely about patience, self-acceptance, courage, determination, and a very deep level of faith. In this reading, there's some very subtle words from Swamiji. You know, faith is the vibration of our actual consciousness, and it draws to us the experiences we need. And making God your partner, no matter where you are in your life, is really one of the most important skills you can develop on the spiritual path, to really and deeply believe in divine friendship, in the friendship of the divine. Very early on my spiritual journey, I was living at Ananda Village, and Swami Kriyananda went into a period of seclusion, and he would keep silence during that time. And during that time, I got into a lot of mischief. And I was snarled up in situations and attitudes that were not serving me, and I began to realize that I was drowning in confusion. But I didn't want to disturb Swamiji, because he was in seclusion, but one of my friends told him that Asha's in a mess. So he sent for me, and he didn't break his silence. He sat at his typewriter and typed, and I spoke, and then he would type his answers like this. And he said, why didn't you tell me? I said, sir, you were in seclusion. I didn't want to disturb you. He wrote, you insult my friendship. Wow. That is not at all what I expected to hear. I thought I was being so considerate. You know, I thought I was toughing it out. Why should I bother him about this? This is my problem. I should be able to solve it. He said, you insult my friendship. He said, to imagine I am more interested in what I am doing than in your welfare. You insult my friendship. I've never forgotten that, of course. And I realized he wasn't just talking about himself. He was talking about my own, and by extension, all of us, our inner attitude toward God. And this is where it's helpful to think of the guru, or Jesus, or your guardian angel, or divine mother, some personification of the divine that is very personal to you. Because sooner or later, this relationship with the divine has to become intimate, personal, and completely full of trust. Just completely full of trust. Is there anyone you know in your life, or can you imagine having anyone in your life to whom you can tell anything? And who will respond by saying, I understand. Now, that's different than saying, wow, that was a good thing for you to do. Because generally speaking, we know what's good and bad because we suffer. When we break divine law, we suffer. We don't have to have someone tell us that we've messed up. We already know we've messed up. What we need is for someone to say, I understand. Or, wow, this is really a mess. What are we going to do about it? And we have to have that kind of faith in Divine Mother. We have to have that kind of faith in Guru. You see, otherwise, we insult their friendship. You're there to be glad when I succeed, but when I fail, it's my problem. You're proud of me when I say, God alone, God alone, but when I say, some for God, some for me, which is what, if we're honest, we're saying all the time. And there's nothing wrong with that. We're not fooling anyone. We just have these little things in our hearts that we still want. I was talking to a friend of mine recently, and he has in his life a small boy, a darling boy who's not quite two. And, you know, you do things with little children. Oh, here's a ball. I'll roll the ball to you. Oh, kid gets so excited. He picks up the ball and he rolls it back to you. Good work. That's great. And then you pick up the ball and you roll it back and he rolls it to you. By any objective standard, this is not much of an accomplishment, right? But it's perfectly appropriate given his level of development. You know, it is progress for him to get the point and to coordinate himself to send the ball back and not just put it in his pocket and go run away. He's beginning to learn. This is how you interact. This is how you make friends. This is how you have joy. You know, when we're out there trying to make ourselves pretty so we can attract the man of our dreams, when we're really busy picking out the right hair color, you know, or getting the house just right, or thinking about our careers, checking our portfolios, you know, getting our IRAs just so. You know, we can say, oh, I'll just give it all to God. But that's not necessarily the right accomplishment given our level of development. And do you really imagine that God has so little compassion and understanding in his heart that he doesn't know that? Then he's not going to cheer us for just picking up that ball and rolling it back? Because that's the foundation. In Autobiography of a Yogi, in the very first pages, Master talks about the vivid memories of his infancy. He talks about the pride in the first steps, learning to walk. And he makes reference to people don't appreciate how self-confidence is born from these very small things. When we were filming the Finding Happiness movie and I was working with Nitai, who's been one of the primary developers of the Education for Life method, he's been involved since the beginning. And we were talking about the effect it has on children when you cultivate their strengths, when you make a child-centered educational system instead of a curriculum-centered system. And of course, the children eventually, you know, embrace what they need to learn. In fact, they embrace it far better. But you build it from where they are naturally inclined, whether it's toward, you know, physical strength or emotional sensitivity or intellectual ability, the natural basis of their self-confidence. And then from that, everything else can be built. When you just take every child and try to hammer them into the same slot, the ones who happen to fit will succeed. The others will, generally speaking, just simply lop off pieces of themselves to fit. But you see, children are just us. When you look at us compared to the infinite consciousness. And so God wants us to develop along the natural basis of self-confidence, the natural line that will build our self-confidence. And the desires that we have, on one hand, philosophically, they're all just riding on water. They're all just disappearing. But on the other hand, they're given to us because that is the natural way that we will be able to develop and expand. I was talking to a friend yesterday about, you know, why did you have children? He said, well, I had a great life, but it was all about me. And it occurred to me that maybe that wasn't enough. And that was a conscious decision then to expand into a more selfless reality. Mostly, though, God just pushes us into doing it. I never had children in this life, but I always wanted to. I had such a deep desire to have children. It was one of the surprises of my life that I never did. I hasten to add, a happy surprise, as this turned out now. I'm quite happy never to have done that. But I always thought I would, up until the age of about 20. But the reason I shifted, very simply, I was looking for an expansion of consciousness. I was looking for a way to serve. I was looking for a way to do something meaningful that would allow me, require of me, that I overcome my selfish interests. The reason I gave it up is I realized that Ananda would give that to me better. That my life was meant in a more universal way. And as soon as I understood what I was really looking for, then the desire shifted. Except for like about 15 minutes when a newborn baby was put in my arms, one of our godsons. Oh, and there's actually a photograph of me. First I'm looking at him, then I'm looking at David like this. You know, it's really deep in you. David was so wise. Let's talk about this in a few weeks, he said. By a few weeks, you know, I'd sort of come out of it and I was back to where I have been. But it wouldn't have been wrong. It wouldn't have been wrong at all, because the heart actually knows, because we are nothing but a manifestation of the infinite. And it's not like anything that we want is wrong. In fact, when I was making once a very difficult decision that I wanted to make myself, and I asked Swamiji, you know, is this the right or the wrong decision? He said, it's neither, Asha. Everything is what you make of it. And so we're going to naturally do better going where we're inclined to go. But the entire key is whether we take God with us or not. I mean, even into very unsavory places. It's unfortunate if we are confused about where our happiness comes from. It's unfortunate if we do things that dull our consciousness or set up repercussions that will be difficult to deal with. But it's far more unfortunate if we allow those actions to make us think that God doesn't love us anymore. A man wrote to me about his long process of overcoming drug addiction. And, you know, we pick out of the teachings that which is relevant to us. And he wrote, no surprise that what I picked out of all of Master's writings was the phrase, if you're going to do something you know you shouldn't do, take God with you. He likes that. So my friend wrote, well, I hope he meant that, because he went with me to some pretty unsavory places, is how he put it. But in the end, it ran its course. And because he'd never separated himself from God, when he began to become free, he knew where to take that freedom. Just like the Vedas. Well, when I wanted a hailstorm to punish my enemies, I went to the Vedas to find it. And now that I really want divine freedom, I know where to find it. So this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, oh, wholeheartedly turn everything aside, just give yourself to God, let there be no other reality. Wow, that sounds great. However, if that's a little too arduous for you, then conduct outward worship. You know, just do pujas, do ceremonies, do rituals, learn prayers. However, if that's too much for you, then try to do good work. Try to be a busy little bee and do good things for God. If you can't sit still, if you can't meditate, if you can't that, then just work. That's pleasing to me. And if, even in this, And this is how Edwin Arnold writes it. Thy faint heart fails thee. Sometimes you just have to stand and enjoy the English. Thy faint heart fails thee. Who cannot identify with that? We make these resolutions. This is what I'm going to do. We have some great moment, one of those moments that reminds us why we're on the spiritual path, reminds us what it's really about. But then later, if even in this, thy faint heart fails me, thee, then bring me your failure. Otherwise, we insult the divine love of God. We make God over into our own limited vision of the possible. We're so conditional in the way we love each other. We're so conditional. You're nice most of the time, right? You're attractive except in these ways. And you're just totally icky, totally. And it's not my fault. We're so conditional. We insult the love of God continually. And that's what he's saying to us. Bring me thy failure. Never separate yourself from me. Swamiji, over the course of the many years that I lived with him, I came to appreciate on such a deep level how subtle he always was. His primary objective in all his relationships with thousands of people was to keep the relationship intact. And he would often be silent, make no suggestions, support people in their delusions, because he knew the most important thing was to keep the relationship intact. Sometimes he would commission someone else to deliver the bad news, because it was okay if the relationship broke between many of the Guru Bhais, as long as it never broke between Swamiji and that person. Because sooner or later, in this incarnation or one far in the future, they would remember and they would trust that love. And that love of Swamiji was the representative of Master, representative of Divine Mother in our lives. Now, God is never going to break that trust with you. The question is, how far can you go? How far can we go in our trust of him? That's the whole spiritual path. God bless you.